All right, well, let's have a word of prayer. And we got a lot of material to cover. I mean a lot. So I hope you don't mind if we're here an hour and a half tonight. It probably won't be that long, but we'll probably go over an hour, I'm sure. Father, thank you for our time together tonight, for your word. Again, thank you for the opportunity that we have to open it, the clarity with which you speak on these subjects, the importance to us who are not under the old covenant, thankfully, because a new covenant and a better mediator than Moses has come, and we are under his covenant, and it is his blood, not the blood of bulls and goats, that have not only covered our sin, but taken it away, and for that we are grateful. So thank you for our time together tonight. Help us as we are working our way through what can be very complex subjects, important subjects, but complex. So give us clarity and help in understanding these things, for we pray this in Christ's name. Amen. So tonight we look at the Mosaic Covenant, the Old Covenant, Sinaitic Covenant. 2 weeks from now we'll look at the New Covenant, because you can't talk about the Old Covenant without talking about the New, and you can't talk about the New without at the same time talking about the Old. And then I've had a couple of requests to do one more and cover the Davidic Covenant. So we'll do that. So that'll be 4 weeks from now. But we'll touch on that as well. I've gotten some stuff up here. I'll explain it as we kind of work our way through the notes tonight to help you understand why I've got these diagrams up here and what they actually mean. All right, let's start with the notes. If you don't have your notes, they're in the back. There should be 2 sheets of paper, 3 pages, because the first one is front and back, and then a second page. So if you don't have them all, go back there and pick it up. All right, so the Old Covenant, what's in a name? Well, in the Old Testament, it is called the Book of the Covenant in Exodus 24:7. In five verses later, it is called Torah, which is the Hebrew word for law. In the New Testament, the Greek equivalent of Torah is nomos. Okay, so nomos, you run across that in the New Testament, that's law. It is made with Moses and Israel, according to Exodus 34:27. That is, it is the Mosaic or the Israelite covenant. Now, just for some clarity, who is the mediator of that old covenant? Moses. And from whom did Moses receive the covenant? God mediated through angels. So when you read the New Testament about how the angels brought the covenant to Moses, God is mediating to Moses the covenant through angels. Okay. Evidently, they were the ones on Mount Sinai giving him these details. In 2 Corinthians 3:14, it is called the Old Covenant. And in Hebrews 8-9, it is called the First Covenant. Not because it's the first covenant ever made. We've already seen that there were other covenants made with Abraham, with Noah, maybe with Adam. But it is the first in the sense in its relationship to the new covenant. And of course, the book of Hebrews is all about contrasting old and new. The old covenant with the new covenant, the old mediator with the new mediator, the old sacrifices with the new sacrifices, the old priesthood with the new priesthood. Over and over again through the book of Hebrews, it's those contrasts that are there. So it's old in relationship to the new. It's first in relationship to the last. Okay. A nation is born. This is important. Before the nation of Israel is taken out of the land of Egypt and gathered around Mount Sinai and given this document, the descendants of Abraham are a family, not a nation. They are the Hebrew children. They are not the nation of Israel. One of the significant importances of this particular document is that it is a national, constitutional document. Just like we have the U.S. Constitution, They had the covenant that God made with them at Mount Sinai. It's what makes them a nation. In Exodus 19 through 24, I think you know this, but let me just review. Exodus 19 through 24, the children of Israel are gathered around the Mount Sinai. Moses goes up. He's there for 40 days. They're getting involved in all kind of mischief down at the foot of the mountain. They're wondering if Moses is going to come back. They're getting antsy. Finally, they take all of the gold and silver that the Egyptians had given them on their way out of Egypt. And what do they do with it? They give it to Moses and say, make us a golden calf. It's a terrible thing to do, but that's what they do, right? So they're there. Moses breaks the commandments, breaks the tablets, signifying this is what you have done. I mean, even before you've accepted the covenant documents, you've broken the covenant documents, so let's symbolize it by breaking. Now, he didn't do it over his knee, but he broke the covenant documents, symbolizing the way in which they had broken it. Okay, so they leave Mount Sinai. They come to the threshold of the promised land at Kadesh Barnea. They send 12 tribes in. 10 of them come back and say, no way, no how, not going to happen. 2 come back, Joshua and Caleb, and say, oh yeah, the Lord has promised this land to our fathers. We can take this. The people listen to the unbelieving spies. And so as a result of that, they wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. At the end of that 40-year period of time, they get ready to go back into the land. And for the second time, they are given the Namas, Deuteronomos. Second law. So Deuteronomy is just before they're going back in, and Moses, who's not going to have a chance to go in with him, reads the law, gathers all the people together, and has essentially a covenant renewal ceremony. And says, okay, understand, here are all of the stipulations. You have been miserable in keeping them for 40 years. Do you really think you're going to be able to keep it? Choose today between life on one hand and death on the other. And they go, oh, yeah, we can keep it. Life for us. They enter into the promised land. And almost immediately, you start reading how they break the covenant again. But the covenant document itself in Exodus and Deuteronomy is a constitutional document making the nation of Israel a nation. The people of Israel as a nation. In Exodus, you have the historical setting in chapter 19, the stipulations given to us in chapters 20 through 23, and the most important stipulations in chapter 20 is what? What do we have in Exodus 20? The Ten Commandments, right. Then we have a ratification ceremony in chapter 24. 40 years later, we're in Deuteronomy. And we have, again, this covenant document that's given, like one of those Hittite suzerain vassal treaties that we talked about all the way at the first lesson that we had. There's the title of the covenant given to us in chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. There's a historical prologue. Here's how we got to this place, chapter 1, verse 6 through chapter 4, verse 44. Then there are the stipulations, which take up most of chapter 4 all the way through chapter 32. Then you drop to the very end, to chapter 27, and we have a document clause. And then there is an appeal to witnesses. We have blessings and curses in chapters 28 through 29. Here's what happens if you don't live up to the terms. And here's what will happen if you do. And then finally, chapter 29 through chapter 30, there is a solemn oath ceremony. The people say, yes, we are ready to serve the Lord. So they have covenanted themselves with God, knowing these are the stipulations. Now, there's one other section in the Pentateuch that gives us a lot of law. What book is that? It's that one you get so excited about reading when you, in your Bible reading, and you get to the book of Leviticus and you go, oh, Well, the book of Leviticus is all about laws of consecration. They are laws that are designed to make Israel a distinct nation, a nation that is different from all of the other nations around, so that they will be a holy nation. Their tabernacle, remember the temple isn't built for hundreds of years from now, their tabernacle is going to be a holy place, and all of the utensils that are associated with it are holy. What does the word holy in this sense mean? Set aside. That's a great way to put it. Set aside, unique, different. Sacred is a good synonym for it. I heard somebody else say. Set apart for the Lord. The concept of holy is that whatever is considered holy, whether it's the priest robe or the priest himself or the nation as a whole, is distinct and different because it has come near to God. Moses, take your shoes off. The ground you're standing on is holy ground. What made the ground holy? Because of its nearness and proximity to the Lord. And it is that nearness and proximity to the Lord that makes it different and unique and set apart from all the rest of the sand in the world. So if you are a holy nation, it is because you have come near to God, or more importantly, God has come near to you and has set you apart for himself. So the Levitical laws are meant to be laws that distinguish this nation from all of the other nations. So what are some of the ways in Leviticus that Israel is different than the rest of the nations? Okay, so their worship is to be holy. Exactly. What else? They're a theocracy. So they're not to have other kings. They're to have one king, that is God. What'd you say, Dave? Circumcision. Well, he's a true God. That's exactly right. How many of you have eaten tonight? Did you think about the food that was on the plate and ask yourself, is this clean or unclean? Never even dawned on you, did it? You didn't think about it. You had pork? Okay. These unclean people up here. Right? It, contrary to things that you will sometimes hear, God did not give the dietary laws so that you would be healthy and you'd lose weight if you just eat according to those things. That's not the reason that God gave those laws. It was to distinguish Israel from all of the nations that are around her. Even the clothes that they wore. Right? So that's what Leviticus is all about. Okay. Now, let's get into the heart of this. Is the law, as we have it under the Old Testament, and by the way, the Old Covenant and the law are virtually synonymous. Not quite synonymous. You have a covenant and then the law is in the covenant. But the way in which it is used in both Old Testament and New Testament, the Old Covenant and Torah, the law, are virtually synonymous. That's what we already saw in Exodus 24, where it's called the Book of the Covenant and then later it's called Torah, law. Okay? So the question before us, is this law, this covenant law, is it a unity or is it a complexity? Now, why is this question important? And the answer is because we need to know, now that the old covenant is done away with, it has become obsolete, it's fading away, that's what Hebrews says. Paul will say in a passage that we'll look at tonight in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, that there is a glory that is associated with the Old Testament law. as symbolized in the face of Moses. I mean, there's a glory. God has given this law. It's a marvelous thing that God should gather a people to himself, make them a nation, and give them this law. It's wisdom. It's insight. It's a great, glorious thing. But Paul says, its glory is now fading, and in its place is something even more glorious, a new covenant that is not a ministry of condemnation and death, but rather a ministry of righteousness and life. And that covenant has an even greater glory seen in the face of whom? Jesus. So we are beholding this glory in the face of Jesus Christ. And in that glory, whatever glory Moses had as he came down off the mountain is passing away. It's fading away. It's not as important. So the question that's before us then is the law associated with the old covenant? Now that the covenant is no longer in place, is any of the law binding upon the consciences of believers? And if you know anything about this debate, and I've got an entire bookshelf dedicated to this subject. I meant to bring a bunch of the books just to show you. I've got a bunch, believe me. A lot of ink has been spilled over this subject. There are essentially two views. The view of the Reformed and covenant theology is that this law is divisible into three sections. Anybody know what the sections are? Say? Ceremonial? Civil? Moral. Ceremonial, civil, and moral. In other words, there are certain laws that are associated with worship, the ceremonial laws. Day of Atonement, Passover, feasts that are associated with it, washings that are associated with it, right? There are civil laws. What do you do if you murder somebody? What happens to you if you steal from someone? What happens if the murder was not intentional, right? The kind of civil laws that a nation is going to need to have in order to guide it. And then, according to this, and by the way, this division predates the Reformation a long, long time. And this is an ancient division, okay? It's very old. The third is then the moral law. And where do we primarily see the moral law, according to the Reformed? The Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments. Okay. Is that law, then, civil, ceremonial, and moral? Can we find those distinctions in the text? And if so, is it easy to go, well, these commands are moral, and these commands are civil, and these commands are ceremonial? And my answer to all that question is no. No, those distinctions are not exegetical. They don't arise from the text. There's nothing in either the Old Testament or the New Testament that you can look at and say, okay, clearly the gospel writers or the Old Testament makes distinctions between these parts of the law. There isn't anything like that. The closest that Jesus comes to saying anything that would allow you to divide the law is that he says that there are some laws that are weightier and some that are lighter. But he doesn't say the weightier aspects of the law are the Ten Commandments and the lighter aspects of the law are everything else. He doesn't say anything like that. Take circumcision as an example. Where does circumcision fall in that threefold division of the law? Is it moral, is it civil, or is it ceremonial? Is it? Well, it could be ceremonial, because there is a ceremony associated with it. But that circumcision also makes you a member of the nation. So that sounds civil, doesn't it? And if you talk to Zipporah and say, Zipporah, is circumcision a heavier or a lighter aspect of the law? What do you think she's going to say? Yeah, that's right, you bloody man, because of this, right? Furthermore, think about this phrase. This is one of my pet peeves. Moral law. That's a redundancy. What do I mean by redundancy? It's saying the same thing twice. Can you imagine an amoral law? Of course not. Now, if you're talking about humans, you could think about immoral. Immoral. I've got one too many M's there. You could think of an immoral law, right? We all think of immoral laws that are human. We're not talking about human laws. We're talking about God's given law. Can anybody give me an example of an amoral law? Take circumcision. By all accounts, there are no Christians that believe that circumcision is binding upon people today. So everybody would agree this circumcision does not belong to moral law. Question. If you didn't circumcise your child as a Jewish man, you got a son that's born and you didn't circumcise them, are you just breaking a civil law or are you sinning against God? You're sinning. If you eat food that is unclean, you're not just breaking a ceremonial code. You are sinning against God. It's true of every part of the law. There is no such thing as an amoral law. Every law is moral. If I could just go down a rabbit trail for just a second. You hear people say things like, well, you just can't legislate morality. To which I respond, well, then what in the world are you legislating? Because the moment Congress passes a law, they are not just saying that something is legal or illegal. They are saying that something is right or wrong. All law is moral. There are no such things as amoral laws. So this distinction where some laws are moral and some laws are something else is a distinction that has no bearing biblical basis in the Scriptures. It doesn't exist. Okay. So clearly, I believe that the law, any law, is a unity, not a diversity. The Bible speaks of the law being a unity. Turn to Galatians chapter 3. Look at verse 10. For all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. For it's written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them. Now it's evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. James chapter 2, verse 10. Anybody know what James says there before we even read it? You will when we read it. For whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become accountable for how much of it? All of it. He who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. The reason James gives that, the reason for that aphorism, if you've failed in one area, you've failed in the whole thing, is because the whole law has one author. And the same person who says, don't commit adultery, also said, do not murder. If you don't commit adultery, but you do murder, you've become a transgressor of all the law. This is why he says, so speak and act as those who are to be judged under the law of liberty. We'll talk about that phrase and others here in just a moment. Jesus can say that the law had weightier and lesser components, but nowhere are those designated as these threefold divisions. With the change of one part of the law, the priesthood, the whole covenant has to change. You're in James. Go back just a few pages to your left to the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. Aaron was of the tribe of what? What tribe was he? Levi. So all of Aaron's descendants are the priest. And so we speak of the Aaronic priesthood as the Levitical priesthood, because it's part of the tribe of Levi. That's why Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, gets its name, because so much of it is related to the offerings and the feasts and so forth that the Levites are doing. Okay? The author of the book of Hebrews says that Jesus is a high priest. Now, he's also a king. And what ancestry does he have for his rule and reign? Who? Tribe of who? Judah. Through the family of Jesse and David, right? Okay. What about his priesthood? What about his priesthood? So, question. In the Old Testament, do we have any of the descendants of David who were not only kings, but are also priests? And the answer is no. Because if you're of the tribe of Judah, you can't be of the tribe of Levi. And if you're not of the tribe of Levi, you can't be a priest. So if Jesus is not only just the king, but he is also a priesthood, he can't be a priest in the line of Aaron. Because his family traces its ancestry to Judah through David, not to Aaron and Moses through Levi. That makes sense? Everybody get that? Okay. So whose priesthood is he a part of? Melchizedek. Who in the world is Melchizedek? He's not a Jew. How do we know he's not a Jew? Exactly. He was a contemporary of Abraham, and Abraham paid him tithes. Remember that? He's the king of Salem, who also is not just the king, but also a priest of the Most High God. So in Melchizedek, we have both of those lines brought together. Kingly line, priestly line, because he's not a Jew. There were no Jews at that time. There was just Abraham. Okay. So look in chapter 7, here in the book of Hebrews, and just notice this. Verse 11. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, right? What further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? Now, just a quick point here. That first phrase is the most important. If the Levitical priesthood could have brought perfection, there would be no need for another priesthood. The fact that there is a priesthood based upon the line of Melchizedek means that there was something imperfect about the Levitical priesthood. Okay? Now keep reading. Verse 12. For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. You cannot have the continuing validity of the Old Covenant law and have a different priesthood, because the Old Covenant law only authorized one priestly line. It was the line of Aaron, the Levitical priesthood. So you can't, if Jesus is the high priest after Melchizedek, then he has transgressed the law. unless there is a change in the law. Your sons do not have to be circumcised. Why? Because there's been a change in the law. You don't have to worry about eating pork because there's a change in the law. And if you're going to have a change of priesthood, the author of Hebrews says, you can't have the Old Testament law. You can't. There has to be a change in it. Further, and I've already talked about this, what constitutes these divisions? As I asked a moment ago, was circumcision civil, ceremonial, or moral? Again, I've already said this. In addition, the phrase moral law is a redundancy. All God-given law is morally binding on those for whom it was given. In other words, if you are in covenant with God, the law that is given in that covenant is morally binding on you. That's true on wearing only one type of thread in your clothes. You cannot mix different types of cloths in your clothes according to the Levitical law. It was absolutely forbidden. That is just as morally binding on you as keeping the Sabbath day. Or not using the name of the Lord your God in vain. Or stealing or killing or not honoring your parents, and etc., etc. All the law is morally binding on you. There is no special category of moral law. It's all moral. So the question then is not, is this law moral? Rather, it's, is this law morally binding on me? That's the question that we have to answer. Now, I'm on the second page, if you haven't turned with me yet. Second major division. Is it continuing or fulfilled? Let's talk a little bit about it. First of all, the law has legal character and gracious provisions. Now, let me just say that again. The law is legal in its character and gracious in its provisions. The old covenant cannot be separated from its law. Indeed, law is the chief characteristic of the covenant. The Decalogue, Exodus 20, the covenantal codes, chapters 21 through 23, the holiness codes of Leviticus 17 through 26, the repetition of it all in Deuteronomy. It is legal in its character. You cannot read the Old Covenant without coming away going, wow, that's a lot of law. That's 630-something individual laws that are given to the people of God. I mean, it just reeks legality. This is what God requires of you, and if you don't do this, you have transgressed His law. You have sinned. It has legal character. But it would be a mistake to suggest that the Old Covenant law does not have grace in it. It most certainly does. God gives gracious provisions. Think about the sacrifices to cover your sins, the Passover, the feast that are there. You have things like city of refuge. So you kill somebody, but you didn't mean to. We call that what? Manslaughter. That's third degree. Is that what it is? Third degree? Yeah. So manslaughter. What do you do in that situation? You start running as fast as you can. And you get to a city of refuge, where even for people who have committed manslaughter, there is grace to be had and protection to be had for you. So it's legal in its character, but it's gracious in its provisions. It's not just the provisions that are gracious, but it is also the purpose. Now, you wouldn't know this necessarily from reading the Old Testament, but we don't have to just read the Old Testament. We also have the New. What is the purpose of the law, according to Paul? So it's a pedagogue to lead us to Christ. It's exactly right. Exactly right. Hebrews says that when you're looking at the lamb that is slain in the Passover, or when you're looking at the bull that is slain on the Day of Atonement, on that same day when you watch a goat with a high priest who puts his hands over the top of it and transfers the sin of the people to this goat, and then the goat is led outside and is known as what? The scapegoat. By the way, not the escape goat. I see people call it the escape goat. No, it's the scapegoat. Taking outside and taken away, it's symbolic of our guilt, which Christ will come and take away. So what is when Hebrews is describing these things under the old covenant, what's the phrase that's used of those things? Yeah, that's right. They are types and shadows. Types and shadows. So I think it's B.B. Warfield who said, think about the Old Testament law this way. If I had Zach turn off the lights inside here, after a while, our eyes would adjust. You know, the pupils would get larger and take in more light. And you could kind of look around in here, and you could see some stuff up there on there, and maybe you'd see the general outline of this board over here. If I'm standing up there, you kind of see the silhouette of my body that's there. And then if you turn the light on, you see the reality. So that's what the Old Testament sacrifices are. They are the types and the shadows. And then the New Testament comes and Christ comes on the scene and the light comes on and you go, Passover, High Priest, Day of Atonement, circumcision, all of those things which you were looking at through this dark haze, now you see crystal clear, and it's Christ who is doing all of these works in fulfillment of the types and the shadows. So God gave gracious provisions, but he also gave us gracious purposes. That's why we're not Marcionites. Marcion was an ancient church heretic who basically said, you don't need the Old Testament. You just do away with it. All we need now are the epistles, because that's God speaking to the church today. No. We believe all 66 books of the Bible are inspired of God and are useful for us. And remember, when Paul says to Timothy, all scripture is inspired of God and is profitable, what scriptures was he talking about? Genesis through Malachi. That's right. So it is profitable for us. It's helpful instruction in us in ways that we'll talk about in just a moment. Okay. The purpose of the covenant. Well, as I've already said, it is a national constitution that would set apart Israel from the rest of the nations. Furthermore, in the Old Testament, we are told that it gives us wisdom and understanding to God's people. You know, blessed is the man who does not sit in the seat of the scoffer, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. Whatever view we have of the Old Testament law, it has to take into account that it is a source of wisdom and insight to us. It's a good thing. Furthermore, it is to reveal sin and incite it as a power of the old age. I want you to see this in Romans chapter 7. Romans 7. And look at verse 7. What then shall we say? that the law is sin? Why would Paul have to answer this objection? Because he's already said at the beginning of chapter 7 that our relationship to the law is like a divorce or death. A marriage is canceled at death. In the same way, we have died to the law. Having, verse 6, being released from it. Having died to that which held us captive. So he knows that there are Jewish people in the church at Rome who are going to raise their hand and say, does that mean that the law itself is a sin to us? And he says, no, of course not, by no means. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. You have small children, or you had small children, and you say to them, don't touch this. They hadn't thought about touching it. But as soon as you told them not to, it's the first thing they want to do. They want to touch it. That's what Paul's saying. Once the law comes and says, you shall not covet, all of a sudden in my heart, there's all kinds of covetousness because of my sin. See, I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death. Read Deuteronomy 28. Do all this and you'll live. It promised life. It brought death. Not because there was something inherently sinful about the commandments. They were a perfect expression of God's will for the nation of Israel. But because my sin takes occasion by those commandments, breaks them, and then the curses of Deuteronomy fall on my head. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. For sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me. So the law is holy. The commandment is holy and righteous and good. But it brought about death to me because of my sinful nature. Okay. So it reveals sin and it incites it as a power of the old age. So just real quick. Paul in this section, beginning in chapter 5 and moving through chapter 8, is talking about the contrast of the present evil age and the age to come. And he's saying that Christians belong to both ages. We're born in this present evil age. We're born again into the age to come. But we still live in this present evil age. And there is this expectation that one day I'm going to be liberated from this sinful bondage that I have. But right now, I still struggle with indwelling sin. Okay? But there are powers or authorities or rulers that exist over this present age. Chapter 5, it's death. Chapter 6, it's sin. Chapter 7, it's law. So these three authorities exist in this present evil age. And everybody apart from Christ lives under them. You are under death. You are under sin. You are under law. But then Christ comes and rescues us so that we are no longer under sin, under death, and under law. That's the phraseology that he uses in this section. They are no longer our rulers. Instead of death, who rules us? Life. Instead of sin, righteousness. Instead of the law, it's grace. That's Paul's language in these chapters. So the law is one of these powers of this old age that ruled over us. But as Paul's going to say in Galatians chapter 3, now that we have come to an age of maturity, we no longer need it as our pedagogue to lead us to Christ because Christ himself has come. But Jesus, just that point again in Galatians 4, Jesus, at just the right time, is born of a woman, born under the law. Why? That he might redeem us from the law. Okay. All right, keep going. It is to anticipate the coming of Christ through its forms and shadows, Hebrews 10, 1 and following. There is also a built-in obsolescence. What do we mean by built-in obsolescence? So this is a manufacturing concept. Okay. So Dave has his eye on a new car. Mary Beth gives him permission to go buy one. He goes, buys his new car. I have put an order. I should just use myself as an illustration here. I've just put an order in for a new Ford Maverick. My truck now has 275,000 miles on it. I know one of these days it's going to cost more to fix it than it is actually worth. It's a 2008. Time for Tony to get a new truck. So Ford's coming out with a new Maverick. It's a small pickup truck, smaller than a Ranger. Okay? So sometime between now and hopefully the end of the year, at a plant in Mexico, Tony's Ford Ranger Ford Maverick is going to come off the production line. It's going to be delivered, and Tony is going to drive away with this new truck. And in about 3 years, Ford's going to change the whole design of the body. And I'm going to look at new Ford Mavericks going by, and I'm going to go, I like that grill so much better than mine. Look at the improvement that they made to this or that or the other thing, right? Manufacturers, this is called built-in obsolescence. You build it with the thought that it's going to be obsolete one day so that you will go buy another vehicle. When God created the old commandment, the old covenant, and the law associated with it, he did not intend it to be permanent. He intended it for a particular set time when it would give way to a new covenant that will not become ever obsolete. When it comes with such beauty and such glory and such permanence and such lasting eternality that we never need another one. There's not going to be a newer covenant. The new covenant is it. Now, how do we know that this is true? We've already talked about Galatians chapter 3, so we're going to skip that. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 8. And let's look at verse 6. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it's enacted on better promises. So the mediator is better, the covenant is better, because the promises are better. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Now, whenever you read words like that, you go, what? Hold on, time out. Are you saying that God's given covenant had fault according to it? Well, I'm not saying that. The book of Hebrews says that. Right? Take it up with him. He doesn't mean that there were imperfections or sin associated with the covenant. He was saying it was fulfilling its duty, but what God intended for it to do has now been eclipsed by what Christ has done with this new covenant. He says, verse 8, for he finds fault with them when he says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord. This is Jeremiah 31, 31, where I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. And it is not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. That's how we know he's talking about the Sinaitic covenant, the Mosaic covenant. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. I will put my law into their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God. They shall be my people. They shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, for I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. That's a quotation from Jeremiah 31. Now, he stops quoting, and he makes this point. Verse 13. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one, what's the word that he uses? Obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. So when the writing of the book of Hebrews is taking place, it's not yet vanished. But it's getting there. And it's growing obsolete. When does it vanish? If you said 70 AD, you would be right. After that point, there are no more sacrifices. There is no more nation. It's gone. You can't go to Jerusalem and look at the temple and see smoke rising because of the altar. It's gone. And the author of Hebrews, writing before 70 AD, says it's passing away. It's vanishing. It's growing old. It was intended to do so. God divinely designed it for built-in obsolescence. Okay? We are not under the old covenant. Go to 2 Corinthians. That should say 3, 7 through 18. I gave you the verses and not the chapter. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. So Paul's saying in chapter 3 that he is the minister of a new covenant. Okay? This is Paul the Jew, the Pharisee, who is saying these words. I want you to read these and just think about this. Verse 4. Such is the confidence that we have through Christ toward God, not that we are sufficient in ourselves to claim anything as coming from us, but our sufficiency is from God, who has made us competent to be ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. What letter is he talking about? What is this letter that kills? Well, we don't have, what did you say? The letter of the law. That's right, Lorraine. We know this because of verse 7. Now, if the ministry of death, carved in letters on what? What's he talking about? What was carved in letters on stones? The Ten Commandments, which is representative of the entire law. If the ministry of death, that's what he calls it. He calls it a ministry of death because that's all it brought. Not because it wasn't good and holy and righteous, it was, but because it could not give us what it demanded of us. It demanded perfection and it could not provide perfection, and therefore it became a ministry of death. This is why I get a kick out of driving all around town and seeing people post the Ten Commandments. They think, I'm talking about a lot of people, not necessarily Christians, but they think that, boy, what America needs is a return to the Ten Commandments. Yeah, how did that work out for Israel? I mean, we have a history of an entire nation given God's law where God himself is the king. Why in the world would we think that the United States would be brought to revival through the same law that brought death? Makes no sense. That's how confused we are about what is the power of God to salvation. The power of God to salvation to everyone that believes is not the law. It's what? The gospel. It's the gospel. Okay, keep reading. Sorry. So the ministry of death carved in letters on stone came with such glory that the Israelites could not gaze at Moses' face because of its glory. You remember he comes down and he's shining, right? And everybody has to turn away. That glory was being brought to an end. It doesn't last very long. Will not the ministry of the Spirit, not the ministry of death, but the ministry of the Spirit, have even more glory? For if there was a glory in the ministry of condemnation, so he's called the Ten Commandments the ministry of death, now he calls it the ministry of condemnation, so the ministry of the Spirit, which he now calls the ministry of righteousness, must far exceed it in glory. Indeed, in this case, what once had glory has come to no glory at all because of the glory that surpasses it. So go out tonight. Anybody know what stage of the moon we're at tonight? Me either. Let's pretend it's a full moon. It's not? Well, what stage is it?
I think it's in the last quarter.
Okay. Well, let's pretend it's full moon tonight. Okay? So we're all going to go out, and we're going to look up in the sky, and we're going to see the moon, and we're going to go, wow, look at that. To think, in 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped on that. Isn't that incredible? Look at that. And if you stayed out long enough, stayed awake, and kept looking at the moon, what would happen? The sun would come up. And the brightness of the sun would completely eclipse whatever light the moon had. And that's what Paul is saying. He's saying the law had a glory. It did. It was glorious. It was a revelation of God. How could it not have glory? But there is now a new covenant that is glorious in the way that the sun is glorious. And it has eclipsed the glory of the old covenant because the glory that we see in Jesus is comparable to the glory of the sun, where Moses' glory is comparable to the moon. Where does the light of the moon come from? Where did the glory that was in Moses' face come from? He was in the presence of the sun. With Jesus, where does his glory come from? He is the exact radiance of the Father. When you look at him, you are seeing the glory of the Father. That's what John says in John 1. He says, the law came through Moses, but grace and truth has come through Jesus Christ. And we have beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. He's the sun. Moses is the moon. The moon's wonderful to look at. There is a glory associated with it. But it's eclipsed now that God himself has come, and this new covenant is greater. That's why he says in verse 18, for we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed in the same image from one degree of glory to another. This comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. The law never produced glory in the people that read it. What did it produce? It was a ministry of death and condemnation. The letters written in stone produced in the people that read it, not life and righteousness, but death and condemnation. But when you come to the new covenant and look at the face of Jesus Christ, you're transformed from one glory to another glory to another glory. Now think about Peter. and James and John. And they're on the Mount of Transfiguration. And Jesus is there, and we don't exactly know what's going on here, but there is some sort of glorious transformation of Jesus. And they are given the privilege of seeing it. We're going to see it one day. They got a chance to see it, right? And who's with him? Moses and Elijah, right? The law, the prophets. And Peter, bless his heart. His heart's in the right place. His mouth sometimes isn't. And he says, Lord, it is good for us to be here. Let's make three booths because there are three of you who was here. And what happens at that moment? Elijah and Moses are just blanked out. And a voice comes from heaven and says, this is my son. Listen to him. Because he has come and his glory has eclipsed all who came from before him. Do we listen to Moses? Of course we do. Do we listen to Elijah? Absolutely. Is there a glory with the revelation that they brought to us? Yes. But there is a glory that is resident in Jesus as the mediator of a new covenant that they don't have. They don't have. Okay. So then we have this question. Tony, if the old covenant is no longer binding upon the new covenant believer, then what is the standard for our moral conduct? To put it another way, what is the Christian's attitude toward the Mosaic law? Well, first of all, the believer is no longer under the law, which in its totality has been fulfilled in Christ. Matthew 5, 17 through 20, Jesus says, I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets. Indeed, heaven and earth will not pass away until every jot and every tittle is fulfilled. That's what he came to do. He didn't come to say, hey, everybody, ignore the first 39 books in the Bible that you have. He says, no, 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 no. They have come to be fulfilled by me. I will do it. Every jot and every tittle, the smallest little markings of the Hebrew alphabet, of all the law and the prophets. He doesn't say the Ten Commandments. He says everything from Genesis to Malachi. All of it is authoritative for us in me. Okay? We read chapter 6, verse 14 of Matthew, chapter 9, verses 19 through 21 in 1 Corinthians. I'll let you take a look at that. We've already talked about Galatians 3, 19 through 14, through 4, 14. When the offspring comes, the authority of the law comes to an end. So we've been talking about this offspring, the offspring of Abraham. So the law enters 400 years after Abraham receives the promises. It sits and is meant to get us to the age of maturity. And when we have finally gotten to the age of maturity, its authority now ends. When faith comes, the authority of the Agardian comes to an end. When the time of comes to completion, the authority of guardians and managers come to an end. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. Okay. I want to show you this up here. I've got a diagram, which I put on the board for you, and it has two parts. These are my terms. Whatever good or whatever bad is a part of them, they're mine. I got this concept originally, reading a little book by Gary Long from like 1980, in which he was trying to counteract the influences of theonomy. In those days, okay? But these are my phrases. Think of law this way. There are some laws that are eternal and trans-covenantal. And what I mean by that is that there are laws that predated Exodus chapter 20 and laws that post-dated Exodus chapter 20. These laws are eternally binding upon all people. before Moses ever walked up on Mount Sinai and received the law, these laws were binding, not just on Jews, but also Gentiles. Now, what are these laws? I would argue that there are two. What is the first great commandment? Love the Lord your God. What's the rest of it? With all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. What is the second great commandment? Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Okay? Today, as believers who are in the new covenant, do these laws apply to us? Are we supposed to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength? And are we to love our neighbor as ourselves? The answer is yes, of course there is, right? When Adam was put into the Garden of Eden, he was supposed to love the Lord his God with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength, and he was to love his neighbor, who happened to be his wife, as he loved himself. Every epoch of time throughout all history, these two commandments are binding on all people. Okay? Now, in addition to this, there are what I have called, my terms, temporary covenantal law. Jesus put it this way: all of the law and prophets hang on these two great commandments. Right? So what does it mean to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength if you are a Jew in the nation of Israel? You don't make an idol. Because if you make an idol, you're not loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You don't worship any other gods. You don't take the Lord's name in vain. And he's given you a day of rest, and you are supposed to keep that day of rest because he rested from his creative activity on the seventh day. So if you want to know what Old Covenant law means in relationship to the first great command, you take a look at the laws and you go, okay, some of these laws are related to me, to God. But we also have this eternal second great command, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. In the Old Covenant law, that starts with your parents. Honor your father and your mother. It means that you don't steal from your neighbor. You don't lie to your neighbor. You don't kill your neighbor. You don't commit adultery. You don't covet what they have. And, oh, by the way, there are lots and lots of other laws that tell you what happens if you borrow somebody's implement and you break it? How you're supposed to dress? How you're supposed to worship? These two great commandments are worked out in specific ways for those people that are under the covenant. Okay? But what about us, who no longer are under the law of Moses, as we've seen, but are under the law of Christ? How do these first two great commands work themselves out for us? Well, don't worship another god. Don't make any idols. Don't use the Lord's name in vain. Right? The Sabbath command is not binding on us. I wish I had time to develop that. I don't. It's fulfilled for us. And in a sense, it is binding on us because if you don't enter the Sabbath rest that has been provided by the death of the Lord Jesus Christ, then you will be banished to an eternity of non-rest. Okay? And oh yeah, by the way, in New Covenant law, you're also supposed to honor your parents, which is the first commandment with promise, right? Ephesians chapter 6. But think about all those one another verses. Right? There are a lot of other scriptures which help us know how we are to live under the new covenant. Now, there is contrast and there is continuity. And we should expect this, shouldn't we? Because who is the giver of the law of Moses? The same guy that gave the law of Christ. So don't overplay the contrast to the point that you don't also see the continuity. Here's an illustration that I think I learned from John Riesinger years ago. So what's the constitutional document that that governs those of us who are Americans? What do we call it? U.S. Constitution. We the people of these United States, in order to form a more perfect union, blah, 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 blah. Right? Constitution of the United States. Okay? This was not, the Constitution was not our first governing document. Before we had a Constitution, we had the Articles of Confederation. Now, Dan, since you so properly answered that question, let me ask you this one, and it's a softball. You're going to knock this one out of the park. Once the Constitution was ratified, what happened to the Articles of Confederation? That's right. Does anybody here believe that you are under the authority of the Articles of Confederation? No, of course not. Why? Because we have ratified a new constitutional document. And now that the new one has come into effect, the old one is no longer binding on us. Nobody says, well, I live under the Articles of Confederation as an American. We don't. We live under the Constitution of the United States. Now, question, and I don't know the answer to this, and you're not supposed to ever ask a question that you don't know the answer to. But I'm going to assume that if you looked at the Articles of Confederation and then you read the U.S. Constitution, that you were going to see both continuity and contrast. Some things are going to be the same or similar, and some things are going to be very different. It's no different with this. You look at the law that God gives to Moses for the people of Israel at Mount Sinai, and you look at the law that Christ gives to us, his people, and it should not surprise you that there is continuity there, but there's also contrast. And the reason why there's continuity is because the first great commandment and the second great commandment, which are eternal transcovenantal laws, work themselves out in ways that are similar and yet different. Now, for believers, there's one more law. So, we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We are to love our neighbor as ourself. And then, as an extension of that second great commandment, we are given the new commandment. What's the new commandment? Love one another as I have loved you. Now, the second great commandment will help you not only with believers, but with unbelievers. The new commandment is just the commandment that believers have given to each other. Love one another as I have loved you. So, if you're ever in this ethical quandary, golly, it's 8:16 already. I'm sorry. So if you're ever in this ethical quandary where you're thinking to yourself, what am I supposed to do? Just ask yourself this question. How do I love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength in this situation? Or how do I love my neighbor as myself? Or how do I love my brother and sister in Christ the way Christ has loved me? All of the epistles are just working out one, two, and new. Everything that you read from Romans through Revelation is giving meat on this skeleton. One, two, and new. It's either under this heading, or this heading. Okay. Sorry. So where does the believer find his moral compass? Well, the New Testament tells us, in the law of Christ. In the law of Christ. Paul, in contrast to the Old Testament and first century Judaism, never tells believers to walk according to the law. What does he say? Walk according to the Spirit. Or according to righteousness. The Old Testament tells us to walk according to the law. It's a light to our path. It's a lamp unto our way. Paul never talks that way. As you would expect, there is significant overlap with the Old Covenant and law, since both it and the New Covenant law have the same divine author. Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, has given us his law that, like the Mosaic law, hangs on the two great commandments and the one new commandment. So distinguish between eternal transcovenantal law from temporary covenantal law. The new covenantal law is what Jesus called the new commandment. Paul calls it the law of Christ. James calls it the royal law. That is the law of our King. In short, it's the law of love. Love God, love your neighbors, love your Christian brothers and sisters. All the imperatives of the epistles are expressions of that love command. New covenant theology and progressive covenantalism is not antinomian. Nomos is law, anti is against the law. We are not against law. There is a moral code that has continuity with the Ten Commandments, but in many ways goes deeper and with more stringent rules. The six antitheses of Matthew chapter 5, they're in the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, I went 20 minutes longer than I have been, but there was just a lot of material to cover here. And I didn't even to the section, this third section there, where it says our attitude toward the law. Repudiation, we're not under the old covenant, it's the law. Replacement, we are under the law of Christ. And reappropriation is wisdom. We continue to receive blessing from the law as it conveys great wisdom for the believer. I wish I had time to talk about that, but I have talked about it ad nauseum in sermons for 20 years. Okay. Anything about this that you need clarification on? Because when the covenant is over, then the law no longer. So this is, yeah, so this line distinguishes between the first and second eternal laws and the old covenant law or the new covenant law, which is temporary, not eternal. Yeah, sorry. I should have made that clear. This is talking about this section. This is talking about this section. Okay, any other questions? Yes. No. It may be everlasting, but it isn't eternal. In geometry, a ray is everlasting. Your life that you have in Christ is everlasting because it had a beginning and will not have an end. Eternal is it has no beginning or no end. So I'm using the term eternal in the sense that before Christ came, before Moses came, these laws on which all the law and prophets hang. Sometimes you hear Reformed folks say the Ten Commandments, the moral law, is a summary of the first and second commandments. That's not what Jesus says. Jesus says all the law and prophets. He doesn't say the Ten Commandments. He says all the law and the prophets hang on the first and second commandments. That's different than saying they're summarizing. That's not what Jesus says. I take it from that, then, that all the law that you receive from Christ's mouth and those of his apostles then also hang on the first and second great commandments. Because they're true regardless of what covenant is in force at the time. All right. Covered a lot of material. Next time, okay, so just so you'll know, we're not away from we're not moving away from controversy yet. Today the controversy was about ethics. what law binds the conscience of the believers. Next time, we're going to talk about the new covenant, and invariably that means who are the members. And what will that touch on? Baptism. Baptism. So that's 2 weeks from now. Okay? All right. Thank you, everybody.